From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Ukraine crisis. One Tiananmen organizer forgives her attackers. Unity government launched in Palestinian reconciliation deal, plus D-Day veterans gather to remember. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian military officials say rebels have launched a major attack on a border patrol base in the eastern region at the center of an escalating fight with pro-Russian separatists. VOA's Gabe Joslow in Kiev has our report.
A spokesman for Ukraine's so-called anti-terror operations, Vladislav Selesnyov, says about 200 men attacked a border patrol post overnight in the Luhansk region using small arms and machine guns. Selesnyov says at the same time, snipers fired at the border patrol from positions in a nearby tower block. He says Ukrainian forces suffered some injuries. The battles lasted into the day Monday. The spokesman said the military called in air support, but the aircraft were unable to fire on rebels who had taken positions near civilians.
He says just as the air assault started, the rebel fighters hid in a residential building adjacent to their base. From there, Selesnyov says, they watched until the government aircraft left, then they came back and continued shooting.
Ukrainian media report 5 militants were killed during the battle and 10 border guards were injured. Ukraine is stepping up its fight against pro-Russian separatists who have taken control of some areas in Luhansk and neighboring Donetsk province. Fighters from across the border in Russia have been seen among the rebels, though Moscow denies any involvement. In a separate development, Russia's state-run gas company, Gazprom, has delayed for 1 week the threatened shutoff of supplies to Ukraine after Kiev paid some of its debt to Moscow. The two sides have been engaged in discussions in Brussels to reach a solution to a pricing dispute. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kiev.
Against the backdrop of ongoing violence in Ukraine, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Monday that Russia is submitting a draft United Nations Security Council resolution calling for the creation of humanitarian corridors in eastern Ukraine to allow residents to escape the fighting. Lavrov told reporters the resolution also calls for an end to ongoing violence in that region and said the situation there is worsening. He said our Western colleagues have been telling us for quite a long time that as soon as the presidential election is held in Ukraine, the situation will calm down. But he says everything is happening in exactly the opposite way. And at the U.S. State Department, spokesperson Jennifer Psaki criticized Russia's proposal for an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council to introduce a resolution aimed for immediate ceasefire in Ukraine.
On the proposal, the UN proposal, it is hypocritical of the Russian leadership to call for an end to violence and the creation of humanitarian corridors when at the same time armed irregular forces are entering Ukraine from Russia, weapons are being brought illegally from Russia into Ukraine, Russian-backed separatists are attacking new targets and holding OSCE monitoring teams hostage, and Russia is doing nothing to stop these activities.
Meantime, the office of British Prime Minister David Cameron announced that he will hold a face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Friday. That will happen in Normandy, France, where both will attend events marking the 70th anniversary of World War II's D-Day landings. And later in the program, British veterans of D-Day gather to remember those landings.
I'm Ira Melman with an invitation for you to come and visit the American Cafe. It's a place where you can come and get a taste of America, from the bitter to the sweet. This past week, the United States recognized some mistakes it had made in the past.
Some of these soldiers fought and died for a country that did not always see them as equal.
For some in the Asian American communities, some stereotypes, although positive, are not always helpful.
What ends up happening is that we don't see what problems actually exist under the surface.
And then there are those who put it all on the line at a very popular festival in the capital city of Texas.
I don't know what to do with my life, but I really, 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 really want to be famous.
Come and visit the American Cafe. We have a new program for you every week. You can hear it on the radio, on the web, or iTunes, or at voanews.com. Come join us. No reservation necessary.
A quarter of a century after the deadly crackdown on demonstrators gathered in Beijing's Tiananmen Square, one of the student organizers of those demonstrations, Chai Ling, talks about what happened then in the context of today.
We also hope this year, 25th anniversary, will be a time that the new leadership of China will have the courage to face what happened in 1989 and the brutal massacre, and to be able to owning up both the mistake of making those decisions and also the enormous pain and consequences it caused the victims' families. We pray to hope the leader of China today will compensate those victims' families, give them the right more openly, publicly, so they can heal, and also to hold accountable for those who have ordered and executed the massacre. But we do pray for this process would take place in a spirit of both in truth and also in forgiveness, and lead to ultimate reconciliation and freedom in China.
Speaking with Reuters TV, Chai Ling, who now lives in the U.S. city of Boston, Massachusetts, credits God with her ability to forgive those who ordered the Tiananmen massacre. Chai's forgiveness is not set well with everyone. The group Tiananmen Mothers responded harshly, expressing disappointment with Chai and underscoring their call for truth, compensation, and accountability. Tiananmen Mothers is a group made up of family members of those killed during the Tiananmen Square protest in 1989. Some young people in China today feel those events of June 4, 1989 have been wiped out of Chinese history. It is absent from the textbooks and classrooms. It is scrubbed off of China's internet and is missing from its own version of Wikipedia. But Lu Xiuxuan, a student in Beijing, told Associated Press, even with efforts to erase the events of Tiananmen, somehow the story has survived. The highest-ranking Chinese general attending a security summit in Singapore lashed out at both Japan and the United States for criticizing Beijing's activities in disputed areas of the South China Sea. Lieutenant General Wang Guanzhong, deputy chief of China's general staff, told the Shangri-La Dialogue that comments by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel were provocative and unacceptable and suggested they were coordinated. Mr. Hagel on Saturday accused China of destabilizing and unilateral actions asserting its claims in the South China Sea. He said Washington would not look the other way if international order is threatened. On Friday, Mr. Abe pledged Japan's utmost support to Southeast Asian nations and their efforts to ensure the security of their seas and airspace. He also vowed Japan would play a greater role, more proactive role in peacemaking. John Blaxland, a senior fellow and security analyst at the Australian National University, told VOA's Victor Beatty, China and the United States and Japan are no further apart on maritime tensions, but the summit brought the dispute out into the open.
China feels that it can assert its claims over the South China Sea and the East China Sea according to its interpretation of the rules, and that really no one is in a position to challenge them seriously. Nobody wants to make a big issue out of an oil rig, the spraying of water on a vessel, the sinking of a fishing boat, challenges in the South China Sea over disputed territory, and over the Diaoyu Senkaku Islands. This is just not what people want to fight over. They're trying desperately to avoid that. But the rhetoric from either side, from both sides, from all sides, is getting increasingly dangerous, increasingly hot-headed, increasingly uncompromising, and it is not putting anybody in a good position for compromise.
In a major speech at the security summit in Singapore, Japan's Prime Minister Abe said Japan intends to play a greater and more proactive role. Later in his speech, he talked about providing patrol vessels to the Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia. and urged all people in the South China Sea to observe international law, a veiled reference to China.
Mr. Abe is doing this for a number of reasons, of course. He's doing this for domestic political reasons. He's doing this to bolster up support in the region. He's doing this to counter China. But the question is how effective he is likely to be. He might be able to offer the Vietnamese some vessels, but really, what difference is that going to make? What difference is further support to the Philippines going to make? It's hard to see a situation emerging where Japan's actions will actually pressure China realistically to back down. China is not in a mood to back down. There's a number of reasons for that. As we know, there's domestic reasons, there's international reasons, but the rhetoric that we heard from General Wang and Ms. Fu Ying at the Asian Security Summit speak very clearly to the view out of Beijing, which is quite confrontational on this. They're not in a mood for backing down. They are in a position where they feel they can throw their weight around, and using the clever tactics of white painted boats or red painted boats and water cannons rather than live fire, they are able to operate below the threshold that would trigger a massive retaliation, which is simply not on the card. No one is realistically talking about anybody retaliating against China. Everyone's too afraid to do so.
Japan's Chief Cabinet Secretary Yoshihide Suga on Monday said in Tokyo, General Wang made claims based on mistaken facts and defamed our country. He says the Japanese delegation in Singapore made a strong protest against the Chinese remarks. Tensions in the South China Sea have centered in recent weeks around a Chinese state-owned deep water oil rig located near the Paracel Islands, which Vietnam considers to be within its exclusive economic zone. Beijing and Hanoi also have traded accusations about the sinking of a Vietnamese vessel near the oil rig.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has sworn in a unity government under a reconciliation deal with a rival Hamas group. VOA's Scott Bob reporting now from Jerusalem.
Mahmoud Abbas, who also heads the mainstream Fatah Palestinian group, presented the reconciliation government at his headquarters in Ramallah. He says the government is a temporary one, and its duty is to prepare for elections soon, in addition to its duty to help the people. He said the new ministers are technocrats and independents, and that none of them belonged to either Fatah or Hamas. He added the new government would abide by commitments made by previous Palestinian administrations and by agreements ratified by the umbrella Palestine Liberation Organization. The elections are aimed at ending a split with Hamas that began when Hamas seized control of the Gaza Strip 7 years ago. Hamas is not a member of the PLO. It opposes negotiations with Israel, which it wants to destroy. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his government would not negotiate with any Palestinian group that included Hamas. He said he is calling on all responsible elements in the international community not to hurry and recognize a Palestinian government that included Hamas. Mr. Netanyahu said Hamas is a terrorist organization that calls for the destruction of Israel, and this will not strengthen peace, but rather strengthen terror. Mr. Abbas announced a reconciliation deal was imminent after talks broke down with Israel over reviving the stalled Middle East peace negotiations. Fatah and Hamas announced they were reconciling nearly 2 years ago, but implementation of the deal encountered many obstacles. Israel, following the Hamas takeover in Gaza, imposed a blockade on the enclave that crippled its economy and caused frequent shortages of basic goods. Gazans survived in large part on humanitarian aid and hundreds of smuggling tunnels into Egypt. Most of the tunnels were destroyed after the coup last year that brought the military to power in Egypt. The new Egyptian government considers Hamas to be an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which it has vowed to destroy. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Libyan military forces loyal to a former army chief of staff battled militiamen from the al-Qaeda-affiliated Ansar al-Sharia group in Benghazi. Edward Uranian reports.
Libyan army helicopters strafed positions of the al-Qaeda-linked Ansar al-Sharia militia in the eastern port city of Benghazi Monday amid sporadic fighting. Libyan warplanes also overflew the skies of the city as militia anti-aircraft gunners opened fire on them. The clashes reportedly began when Ansar al-Sharia militiamen attacked the Libyan Special Forces Battalion base with rockets and mortars, inflicting casualties. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
World Health Organization reports that cholera is spreading rapidly in South Sudan's capital city, Juba. WHO says aid agencies and the Ministry of Health are intensifying efforts to stop the spread of the disease in the city and to prevent outbreaks in the other parts of the country. Lisa Schlein reporting from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization is worried at how quickly cholera has spread in South Sudan's capital since the disease was first confirmed on April 23rd. It reports more than 1,000 cases, including 27 deaths in Juba, with unconfirmed cases reported in other parts of this war-torn country, including in Jonglei, Lakes, and Upper Nile states. A WHO specialist in cholera, Dr. Dominique Legros, says the unsanitary conditions of the displaced persons camps and the onset of the rainy season are expected to accelerate the spread of this often fatal disease.
I think that we have to be ready for a situation of large epidemic, if you want to call it an epidemic, in the country. It's very difficult to predict how outbreaks of cholera evolve. We know that they go very fast, and we have seen this again this time in Juba. For the moment, outside Juba, we don't see so far big outbreaks.
Legault says controlling the outbreak in more remote areas will be complicated during the rainy season as roads become impassable, cutting off access. He says this period usually provokes an upsurge in cholera cases due to flooding that contaminates water sources. Cholera spreads through contaminated food and water. It causes severe vomiting and acute diarrhea, which can lead to dehydration. It can kill within hours if left untreated, but most cases are successfully treated with oral rehydration salts. Legault says two main strategies are in place for containing the disease. In Juba, he says, aid workers are trying to improve sanitation and provide safe water. He says they also are setting up treatment centers so people can easily access health care.
Then outside Juba, we have a system in place that was already in place before that we have reinforced, with notably rapid tests for cholera, to detect as early as possible upsurge of cholera cases, beginning of outbreaks, so that we can try to contain them. And of course, in similar settings, preposition material for treatment and staff when needed.
Legros says security concerns because of the ongoing war hamper efforts to control the disease. For example, an evening curfew in Juba limits movement, making it difficult for both cholera patients and healthcare workers to go to treatment centers. He says a few weeks ago, WHO and partners vaccinated displaced people at a camp in the northern part of South Sudan. But because of heightened security, health workers are not able to return to the camp to carry out a second round. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
British veterans of the D-Day landings have made a nostalgic return to the warship that played a pivotal role in the operation, the HMS Belfast. Several dozen survivors attended a ceremony on board the ship, now a floating museum on the River Thames. 70 years ago, HMS Belfast was part of a huge armada numbering thousands of vessels that crossed the sea from England to the Normandy coast. Edward Cordery, now 90 years old, spent 2 years on the Belfast as a torpedo operator, and on D-Day he worked as a crane driver to bring on board the casualties from the beaches.
90% of them were past help. That's the sad thing of it, because the conditions of getting them to the ship weren't good from their survival point of view, you know. But he just did it in the hope that they would survive, but most of them came back on deck and were just put over the side.
During a ceremony on Monday, the veterans met with Prime Minister David Cameron.
70 years ago, you did your country proud, and your country will always, always be immensely proud of you. Thank you.
President Obama is headed to Europe with stops in Poland, Belgium, and France, where he'll speak Friday at an Omaha beach in Normandy for a ceremony marking the anniversary of D-Day. Russian President Vladimir Putin will also attend. No meetings are scheduled between the Russian and American presidents. But as we said earlier in the program, Prime Minister Cameron is set to meet with President Putin in Normandy. Spain's King Juan Carlos is stepping down from the throne, clearing the way for his son, Prince Felipe, to take over. Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy made the abdication announcement Monday on national TV, followed a few hours later by the king himself, who told the nation it deserved to be led by a younger generation.
Por todo ello, guiado por el convencimiento de prestar el mejor servicio a los españoles,
the king said, because of all of this and guided by my conviction to serve Spaniards in the best manner and recovered both physically and in my institutional activity, I've decided to end my reign and abdicate the Spanish crown so that the government and the general courts decree the effectiveness of the secession conforming to constitutional provisions. Not immediately clear when the abdication will be taking place, allowing the 46-year-old Felipe's assumption of power. 76-year-old Juan Carlos oversaw the country's transition from dictatorship to democracy, coming into power in 1975, just 2 days after the death of longtime dictator Francisco Franco. He said he trusts that his son, only son and heir to the throne, is prepared, but Juan Carlos's popularity has been deeply eroded by scandals swirling around him and his family. Went on a luxury elephant safari to Botswana in the middle of Spain's financial crisis, during which he broke his hip and had to be flown back to Spain for medical treatment aboard a private jet. His image has been tarnished also by the investigation of his son-in-law, who is suspected of embezzling large amounts in public funds. Should also note here that thousands of fans watched Brazil's final training session that happened on Monday before its World Cup warm-up game against Panama. Today's game will be the team's second to last before playing Croatia in the World Cup opener on June 12th. The host, Brazil, of all the World Cup games, 5 weeks of it, face Serbia on Friday in its final tune-up. And you should note that we have world coverage of the World Cup events. You can find us on Twitter. Hope that you will follow us at VOA Football. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us on the Internet anytime at voanews.com. And we hope that you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers, Zarat Abuzaid and Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On June 3, 1726, Scottish scientist James Hutton, widely considered the father of modern geology, was born. Hutton expanded on the study of minerals and rocks in his publication, Theory of the Earth, in which he proposed that the Earth had developed over a long period of time rather than being created all at once. On this day in 1808, Jefferson Davis, the only president of the secessionist Confederate States of America, was born. Davis, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy, was elected to Congress and appointed Secretary of War. A strong supporter of states' rights and slavery, Davis returned to his native Mississippi when it withdrew from the Union. In 1899, Austrian composer Johann Strauss II died. Strauss is best known for his waltzes, including the Blue Danube. The composer was widely acclaimed as the king of the waltz in Europe and the United States. In 1962, a chartered Air France Boeing 707 jetliner en route from Paris to Atlanta, Georgia, crashed during takeoff, killing 130 people on board. On this day in 1989, Chinese army troops headed to Beijing to put down a huge student-led pro-democracy demonstration. Also in 1989, Iran's Grand Ayatollah Khomeini died. The Ayatollah, an Iranian Shiite leader, returned from exile in France to lead the Iranian Islamic Revolution. And on June 3, 1999, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic agreed to end the conflict against Kosovo. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
5 years ago, realizing the global economic recession and rising food prices were forcing more and more people into food insecurity, President Barack Obama committed $3.5 billion over a three-year period to a new global initiative that would focus on reducing hunger, undernutrition, and poverty. Less than a year later, in May 2010, the Feed the Future initiative was born. Under the leadership of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, Feed the Future focuses on smallholder farmers, particularly women. That is because growth in the agricultural sector is at least twice as effective in reducing poverty as growth in other sectors. Thus, USAID partners with governments, civil society, the private sector, and donor organizations to tailor Feed the Future programs to reflect local priorities. Working in 19 focus countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, Feed the Future has leveraged more than $18.5 billion in investments, introduced affordable new technologies to increase agricultural production and manage the risks of a changing climate, and introduced nutrient-packed foods to millions of mothers and children around the world. In early May, USAID released the 2013 Feed the Future Progress Report, which indicates that the program has been phenomenally successful. Last year, the initiative helped nearly 7 million farmers and food producers use new technologies and management practices on about 9.9 million acres of land. It has reached more than 12.5 million children with nutrition interventions that can help them thrive, thus affording them a chance at a better future. So, for example, 3.3 million smallholder farmers in Bangladesh increased their rice yields by 20% by using improved seed, fertilizer, and better farm management practices. In Senegal, farmers now produce more rice, enough to feed over 400,000 of their fellow citizens for 1 year. And in Honduras, 4,300 families have advanced well above the $1.25 per day poverty line, in part by increasing horticulture sales by 125%. In his 2009 inaugural address, President Obama said, "To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds. And to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty, we say we can no longer afford indifference to suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect. For the world has changed, and we must change with it."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.